Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, Cyber War, Russiagate is us. Since November 2016, the U.S. establishment press, pundits, prognosticators, and politicians have repeated ad nauseum that Russia hacked the 2016 U.S. election, helping put into office Donald Trump. On today's program, we're joined by media scholar Rob Williams to ask key questions about the uncritical acceptance of this narrative. Rob Williams rejoins the program talking about a recent book review he did for Project Censored. He reviewed Kathleen Hall Jameson's Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. For the hour, we ask crucial questions about Jameson's narrative, and we offer different perspectives. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsed.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are rejoined by Dr. Rob Williams. Rob Williams is a media communications professor and new media consultant who lives and works out of Vermont's Mad River Valley. In addition to serving as publisher of the Vermont Independent, Rob teaches a wide range of communications classes at the University of Vermont, Champlain College, and Sacred Heart University. He's published numerous chapters and articles with us at Project Censored over the years, online and in our annual print books, including most recently for the Censored Notebook online, The Post-Truth World, which was an update on the propaganda model for the 21st century. Today, Rob Williams joins us from Vermont to talk about a recent book review that he did for Project Censored called Cyber War, hashtag Russiagate is us, and the letters U and S are capitalized as in U.S. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, great to be with you.
Great to have you on for such a timely issue. Those folks that maybe thought that somehow the clouds of Russia would blow on by and sober heads would prevail and we would be looking at real homegrown vulnerabilities and troubles with our election systems and our population. Of course, we now know coming up here 2 years later that there is certainly something going on with Russia, Vladimir Putin, and their interest in meddling in U.S. politics and also around the globe. But this is a story that kind of goes two ways, Rob Williams, and we'll get into this. Your recent piece is about Kathleen Hall Jameson's new book. She's a rock star comms professor who just did a new book called Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. That's an Oxford University Press book from 2018. By the way, this book review that we're talking about with Rob Williams today is at projectcensored.org under our Censored Notebook, and you can read along, just published. So this is hot off the presses, Rob. And as I was noting, the Russia topic tends to go two ways. It's either, as Kathleen Hall Jameson seems to be convinced, and you'll tell us much more, that Russia did it. And then there's the opposite view, which is on the far right and even some on the far left that say, nope, there's nothing there. However, Paul Street, Masha Gessen, even we at Project Censored, we think that there's a lot of gray area and there needs to be some disambiguation and some clarification, which you, by the way, provide. So let's dive into this hot topic here and tell us a little bit about cyber war.
So Kathleen Hall Jameson is a rock star, as you said, and I kind of came to this book, and it is a mouthful of the title, Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. And it is an Oxford University Press publication. So there's been a lot of talk about Russiagate, and I've been tracking the story for a while, as I know you all have at Project Censored. But when one of our own critical media literacy scholar of the stature of Kathleen Hall Jameson weighs in book-length format, I think it's time to sort of sit up and pay attention. So I approached cyber war with an open mind. I have a lot of respect for Jameson's work in the past. I've learned a lot from her approach. So I was curious to see how she built her argument for alleged Russian hacker and troll and Kremlin interference. And unfortunately, I think she really kind of dropped the ball on this. And I was sort of surprised, actually, by the book by the time I got to the end of it. I did sit down and read it very closely over the course of an afternoon, including all the footnotes, because I was really trying to figure out the nature of her argument. So that's, in capsule form, my take on the book.
And actually, there's so many places we can go from in terms of the points that you bring up in the review, critiquing some of the claims in this book, Cyber War. Also, just to let listeners know, of course, that we at Project Censored have been covering issues related to this. In fact, in our most recent book, story number 6 is Russiagate, Two-Headed Monster of Propaganda and Censorship, based on Aaron Maté's writing at The Intercept, Norman Solomon's writing for Truth Dig, Robin Anderson for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, also Matt Taibbi on The New Blacklist. And of course, Taibbi even had a name that he gave for people that were infatuated with Russia all day, like Rachel Maddow. He called it Putin derangement syndrome.
That's
so
right.
We've been covering this issue, but we've been trying to cover it carefully. It isn't really a black and white story. So why don't you walk us into some of the review and some of the points and into some of that gray zone?
You know, it's curious the way she starts out the book for a scholar. She begins with a whole raft of epigraphs, of short quotations at the beginning of the book, even before she gets into her analysis. Most of them are from members of the U.S. intelligence community, people like Michael Hayden, formerly of the NSA, James Clapper, Bob Mueller. These are all names that are probably familiar to Project Censored listeners. But I got a little edgy when I saw that go down, because certainly there's a U.S. intelligence community version of events, and they tend to mount a unified front there. That, I guess, set me on edge a little bit. But again, I tried to approach the book with an open mind. So to quickly sketch out her argument, she divides her analysis of alleged Russian interference or trolling or all of those into four parts. Part one, she looks at what she says, who did it, why, and what research says about how it might matter. And in part one, she flags the Internet Research Agency, which is a Russian troll farm. Presumably, your listeners are familiar with that particular element of the story. The second part, she looks at what she calls the prerequisites of Russian troll influence and asks the question, were Russian trolls sufficient and sufficiently persuasive to affect the outcome of the 2016 election, decided in 3 states by about 78,000 votes? By the way, she keeps throwing in the closeness of the election between Mr. Trump and Ms. Clinton.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Rob. Close enough to steal, in other words. I mean, that seems to be the implication, right?
Right, and we should come back around to that in a minute. The third part of the book, she looks at, and this is her language, quote, how the Russians affected the news and debate agendas in the last month of the U.S. presidential campaign. Here's where things kind of went south. And then fourth, she provides what she calls a brief summary of what we don't, can't, and do know about how Russian hackers and trolls helped elect Donald Trump. So those are the four parts of the book. And as you might imagine from that kind of very verbose subtitle, what we don't, can't, and do know, there's a fair bit of hedging going on in the book. And again, to be clear, I'm a fan of Jameson's work in the past. And I think her use of particular analytical techniques, shall we say, that she has used in past books analyzing presidential elections is somewhat useful. But she makes a couple of really big assumptive jumps that I think really killed the book in terms of the accuracy of its analysis. So we can get to that, those two assumptions, in a minute. But I just wanted to lay out her argument first.
Okay, and so, again, this is a topic that we can't seem to avoid. It's all over the corporate press, corporate media. The Democrats, you know, won't let go of it. Republicans are trying to pretend that there's nothing much to worry about. What we do know, of course, is that the special counsel investigation has certainly found some troubling things. Perhaps RICO is going to come into play, certainly with people like Flynn and the so-called fixer, Michael Cohen, right, who's supposed to testify to Congress. So in other words, we know that there's some criminality here. I suppose we even, would you agree, we can say that there were efforts by Russia to meddle in the election?
Well, that's a good question. I think there were certainly interests and efforts amongst Russian trolls who do what all trolls everywhere do, which is to try and increase click-throughs and maximize profits through the creation of appealing content, which is then inserted into whatever exciting social media conversation happens to be going on. The 2016 presidential election is a pretty big global social media conversation. So if I were a troll in any country of any sort, I would be interested in tapping into that particular conversation to maximize click-throughs and thus perhaps profits. So the point here is that Russian troll farmers probably behaved as any troll farmers would anywhere when it comes to the election.
So indeed, even if we're granting then that there is some interest there, and of course it's arguable that leaders around the world may have preferred one of the candidates to the other, let's also remember that the United States is no newcomer to the global stage of interfering in elections. Even just in the past few decades, 20-some times, provably Russia 3 by comparison, not to dissuade from anything else that we're going to be talking about, but messing around in other countries' elections isn't exactly a new thing.
Sure. And to your point of earlier, you know, if I were Vladimir Putin sitting in the Kremlin in and around Moscow and looking at the two choices that emerged for the U.S. presidential campaign in 2016, knowing what I knew as Vladimir Putin about Hillary Clinton, given her long and distinguished record as Secretary of State, et cetera, I would certainly not be interested in her winning, given NATO activities on Russia's border, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not surprising that the Putin government would be interested in the other guy, particularly because it's clear that Mr. Trump had a number of real estate dealings going on all over the world, including, as we know, in Russia.
Let's also recall when Hillary's husband, Bill, was in the White House, he was involved in the Yeltsin election. There was meddling going on in that election.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Time magazine openly bragged on its cover about essentially entering the Russian elections so that Yeltsin would emerge as the front runner and then be essentially the U.S.'s guy in a collapsing Soviet Union. So you're right. There's a very interesting history there vis-a-vis U.S. involvement, shall we say, in Russian politics.
So I just wanted to lay that out from the beginning. We're trying to pack a lot into an hour here with Rob Williams. We're discussing a recent book by a communications scholar, Kathleen Hall Jamison, called Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, What We Don't, Can't, and Do Know. And this has been getting some attention, getting a lot of reviews, interviews. So, Rob Williams, what are these two major assumptions? Because anytime we go and look at the way the corporate media, particularly the pro-democratic outlets like MSNBC and Rachel Maddow in particular, they really want to assume that it's just a given that Russia was involved in hacking emails. And you're going to get into that. But this is what's important, is that so many of these assumptions that we're going to be rolling through are just tacitly accepted, right? Like assumptions are. It's almost hard to get through and debunk them because people just automatically default to a confirmation bias.
That's right. Yeah. And part of what's going on here, Mickey, is it's a really interesting kind of critical media literacy point. And that involves verb choice, right? We can talk about Russians hacking. We can talk about Russians meddling. We can talk about Russians interfering. We can talk about Russians massaging. We can talk about Russians conducting a campaign of influence, which may have happened. And each of those four verbs I just laid out there are all very different in terms of the conclusions we should be drawing about how much the Kremlin, let's say, actually participated in whatever happened 2 years ago. So the two assumptions are these, and it was really sort of startling when I read the book closely a couple of times. It was startling to me to realize what Jamison was doing, and she must have been aware of it. But the first assumption that she makes in the book, and this comes around part three of four parts, she suddenly starts talking without offering any proof. She starts talking about how the Russian government hacked, quote unquote, hacked into the Democratic National Committee computer servers, as well as other hacks, and obtained thousands of digital copies of what became known as the Podesta emails, for example, or the Hillary Clinton emails. These were emails that were published by WikiLeaks, which we'll come back around to in a minute. But she makes this implicit assumption without providing any evidence, and then kind of carries the assumption through the second half of the book that it was the Russians that somehow got into the Democratic National Committee computer servers. And that was really strange for me. I had been following the story pretty closely. And there are a number, as I'm sure your listeners, some of your listeners may know, there are a number of very skilled cryptographers and algorithmicians, Bill Binney, formerly of the NSA, former CIA official Ray McGovern, others, who looked at the data around this alleged hack and recognized pretty quickly that based on bandwidth rates, this is a little technical, but it's important, based on bandwidth rates, it appears that the information that was obtained from the Democratic National Committee servers was not hacked, but rather leaked. A leak is a much more high bandwidth situation than a hack would be. So for the Russians or any foreign power to reach into a Democratic National Committee computer and extract information, we could easily, if you know what you're doing, you could easily determine whether or not that was a hack or a leak. And most of the guys who looked at the evidence there concluded that it was probably an internal leak rather than an external hack. Now, here's where it gets complicated, because the Democratic National Committee, rather than turning over its computer servers to the FBI when requested to do so, they went out and hired a private for-profit corporation called CrowdStrike. It's a cybersecurity firm, CrowdStrike, to determine if, in fact, there was a hack. And we probably know how that might go. So essentially, whatever evidence was present was removed from FBI jurisdiction through the turning over of these computer servers to a private for-profit corporation, which also has, by the way, connections to the Democratic National Committee itself. So there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. So that's the first assumption. The Russians hacked into the servers. Jameson sort of asserts that without providing any evidence and then kind of carries that language through the rest of the book. And it was very strange to see her do that, because she's usually very, very careful with her language. I've read all of her other books over the years, and I kind of went back and looked at those, and I was really perplexed by that.
I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri, who you're going to hear from here shortly. We're interviewing Dr. Rob Williams, a media and communications professor and new media consultant who lives and works out of Vermont's Mad River Valley. Rob Williams has contributed to Project Censored over a number of years, to our books, to our website, and especially in our Validated Independent News program, with his students having stories in the top 25 every year. Today, we're talking about a book review that he recently did for us called Cyber War, hashtag Russiagate is Us. And it's looking at some of the many issues around accusations of Russian meddling and colluding in the election. After this brief musical break, we are going to continue our conversation with Rob Williams, and we're going to get into the second of the major assumptions in Kathleen Hall Jameson's book, Cyber War. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're joined once again by Dr. Rob Williams, a communications professor, communications historian, journalist in his own right, longtime contributor to Project Censored, Rob Williams also has a history with the Action Coalition of Media Education, ACME. Rob is very active in a lot of the communications and politics events that go on around the United States and around the globe. And as I said before the break, he's a longtime partner and contributor with us on many projects at Project Censored. Last year, I want to remind people, Rob Williams did a fantastic update on the propaganda model for the 21st century, an article called The Post-Truth World. I urge people to look at the propaganda model of news for our digital age. Today, we're speaking with him about one of the issues that won't go away from American politics, and that's Russia and the 2016 election. Rob did a book review called Cyber War, hashtag Russiagate is us, and we are now speaking with Rob by phone. So, Rob Williams, we want to continue with the conversation. You were laying out a couple of the major assumptions, the first major assumption made in this book. It's getting serious press, serious attention, and accolades. All the more reason not just to pay attention to it, but to carefully read it and deconstruct it, as you have. So there's another major assumption here, however, that you wanted to unpack.
So the second assumption that Kathleen Hall Jameson makes in Cyber War is the assumption that somehow Julian Assange from his Ecuadorian embassy / prison outside of London, and his WikiLeaks team, that somehow WikiLeaks was closely collaborating with the Russian government. And again, she uses these tricks of language in the book to imply some kind of close connection and collaboration between WikiLeaks, which is the world's first truly stateless news organization, I would argue, WikiLeaks and Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. And again, there's no evidence for this. But the language she uses, she talks about Russians hacking into the Democratic National Committee's computer servers, and then she talks about data that was then WikiLeaked. And she uses that phrase. It's an interesting phrase, WikiLeaked, and then connects the Russian government with Assange and WikiLeaks. Now, to be clear, and again, your listeners may be familiar with this, but Julian Assange and WikiLeaks was no friend of Hillary Clinton. The sort of WikiLeaks feud with the Clintons goes back a ways. The Democrats love WikiLeaks when WikiLeaks is calling out the Republicans in power, and the Republicans love WikiLeaks, as Donald Trump said many times on the 2016 campaign trail. The Republicans love WikiLeaks when they're calling out the Democrats in power. But the larger point is that WikiLeaks has always been a stateless news organization beholden to no government or no particular country. And that's what I think gives WikiLeaks its unique news production power in our 21st century digital age. And again, I'm not defending Assange, but I'm simply making the point that WikiLeaks had its own particular interest, I think, in these particular documents that it found itself in the possession of from the Democratic National Committee servers and chose to strategically leak them, deploy them into the U.S. news and conversational space in the months and weeks leading up to the 2016 election. But to hold the Russians accountable for WikiLeaks' decisions seems to me incredibly disingenuous at best. And yet that's exactly what Jameson does.
Furthermore, though, Rob Williams, let's pretend that all that is true. Like, let's just say that, oh, yes, that's what happened. What metric does one use to see how that information competed with all of the din, all of the noise from the corporate media, from right-left media in the U.S., from social media, from actual fake news sites? How does she separate all of this to specifically track that these – how does
that's
one
right.
measure this?
And that's sort of kind of big picture as you step back from the book and kind of reflect on it. That's the big challenge here for anyone who's trying to analyze the impact of this collective messaging. How do you measure how these particular tweets and Facebook messages and leaked information into the news cycle, how did it impact on the national discourse in the United States leading up to the 2016 election? Now, to be fair to Jameson, she makes a pretty credible attempt to try and trace the arc of the impact of the leaks on the news cycles in the weeks and days even leading up to the November 2016 election. But I think you're absolutely right, Mickey. It's really difficult to know how those leaks and those social media messages actually impacted voters. And again, I would urge people to read the book and flag these two assumptions because they're deeply problematic. But I think your question is the right question. It's really hard to measure the impact of those on actual voters.
Chase.
Right, Rob. And what we also know is that Assange and WikiLeaks vehemently state that it was not hacking, that it was leaked to them, and that they were not provided the information from the Russian government itself. So again, take that at Assange's word, but that is what he's vehemently stated in countless interviews. And then another hypothetical, kind of for the sake of argument, to piggyback on Mickey's, is let's say that that information was hacked by the Russian government and released to WikiLeaks. At the end of the day, that was still real information. It's correct information that the public should have been aware of before going to the voting booth. So even how the information was acquired, even if you think it was Russian hacking, still the argument you need to make is, well, does the public not deserve to see that information? And then one thing that I wanted to touch on was that we wouldn't have Russiagate if it wasn't for the media giving so much airtime to these arguments in the first place, right? And one of the arguments or the talking points that came out immediately was 17 intelligence communities agree that this information was hacked and that Russian interference was involved. So I was wondering if you could touch on this specific claim that 17 intelligence communities agree, because you've stated here in your article that it's really mostly Mueller, Clapper, and Hayden, so three government officials, all of which have somewhat imperfect records on being honest and transparent with the public. So I'm wondering how you would address, or if the author of this book addresses that claim that 17 intelligence communities agree.
Sure. Thanks, Chase. That's great. I really go back to Ray McGovern, Bill Binney, and some of these other former U.S. intelligence individuals now turned whistleblowers. They formed an organization 15 years ago now called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, VIPS. And a number of them have pointed out, they've sort of given the lie to this claim that 17 U.S. intelligence agencies all agree that this was some kind of a hack from outside. I think that was the story that was advanced right away by Hillary Clinton, looking perhaps for an excuse to justify her loss and sort of blame the Russians and WikiLeaks and James Comey and whoever else you wanted to blame. But I think that what happened there was these NSA cryptographers, CIA officials kind of came out of the woodwork, McGovern, Binney, others, and said, actually, when you look at the data as we have, it's not clear to anybody, really, that this was a hack at all. In fact, evidence indicates that it probably was a leak from inside. So I think that particular story kind of collapsed inward on itself. Although, Chase, you're right, it's still being sort of repeated from time to time in popular U.S. news, quote-unquote, outlet.
But repeated as a statement or an assertion where there has never been physical evidence technically produced behind it. It was just said that Clapp, right, who said that there are 17 agencies in agreement about this. But how does one, how does 17 agencies distill that? I mean, in this kind of hideous bureaucracy, I mean, there's an entire subcategory of government humor here, right, that we're blowing past about bureaucracies, right hands, left hands, et cetera, et cetera. And without opening that can of worms, it seems to be just on the face of it an absolutely extraordinary claim, which likely would require extraordinary evidence that we actually haven't been given access to.
That's exactly right, Mickey. And it's pretty interesting to watch in Jameson's book, In Cyber War, she really, you know, to Chase, to your question, your second question, she really doesn't deal with these claims that are made by Clapper and Hayden and Mueller and others. She accepts them at face value, beginning, as I mentioned earlier, with these epigraphs at the very beginning of the book, even before you get to the book itself. And then there's never any question that the U.S. intelligence officials might not be being straight with us. And that's really strange, again, for someone who purports to be a scholar of critical media analysis with the street cred and the CV that Jameson has. And again, I'd like to be wrong about this, but I really was sort of baffled by her kind of blind acceptance of these statements as fact. It was really troubling.
Rob Williams, you know, on this issue, there's no shortage of that. I mean, Rachel Maddow has a PhD, yet over there, it's all Russia all the time. you know, our good colleague at Project Censored and Acme, our mutual friend Nolan Higdon, and I have just been finishing up a book for City Lights called United States of Distraction that'll be out later in the summer. The book isn't about Russia, but it's curious that Russia actually has become this distraction on two sides. And Maddow has been in the so-called liberal press on television, you know, while the right, of course, has Fox News and they had Breitbart and so forth. Maddow has really dug in deeply here, particularly between February 20 and March 31 of 2017, when a lot of this was really gaining momentum as a topic. Over half of Maddow's show, 640 of the nearly 1,200 minutes she was on the air, was devoted to investigating Trump's ties to Russia. And that's just an example, right? And let's not forget that a couple weeks prior to the election, she said that Clinton could attain a, quote, Goldwater-style landslide. And the reason I bring that up is that kind of failed prognostication foreshadowed how MSNBC and their pro-Clinton corporate media allies at the New York Times and Washington Post would be seeking a scapegoat. And they were, right from the get-go. They were looking at fake news. Washington Post was platforming prop or not. They erroneously claimed that Russians hacked a power grid in your own state, Vermont, that was completely false. You know, the old gray lady, as it's called, all the news that fits the print, as I say, the New York Times. It seems like every 2 months or so, they're breaking two or three stories that are smoking gun stories that within weeks are slowly unraveled and debunked. Most recently, Aaron Mate did this with a couple of stories over at the Times. And again, that doesn't throw out any of the other stuff that we already said, right? It's just it's a more nuanced narrative than Russia did or didn't do anything. And the nuanced view is, well, buttressed by more evidence, admitting that we need more information.
Speaking of nuanced view at this, a lot of this debate focuses around Facebook and the manipulation or potential bots or users and money flowing through Facebook. But what we know is that only about $100,000 worth of Facebook promoted content came from these supposed Russian bot farms. But Trump spent millions of dollars advertising on Facebook. So I don't understand why the assumption is that the $100,000 of Russian memes and targeting was the winning horse, whereas Trump literally had a concentrated campaign focusing on spending his money and advertisements through Facebook, whereas the Clinton campaign just wasn't.
That's right, Chase. Yeah, and Mickey well said. Nate Silver, who is a U.S. statistician, your listeners may know his work. He's built a career on analyzing statistics in the world of baseball and the world of U.S. politics. And he said a couple of weeks ago that if he were to rank Russian influence on the 2016 election on a list, he said it wouldn't even crack the top 100 reasons why the election turned out the way it did. He was pretty vocal about that. And I end the piece at Project Censored on cyber war with a pretty interesting summary from Aaron Mate's work, and he's been tracking the story very closely. He wrote a piece for The Nation just a couple of weeks ago, and it might be worth reading it here because it's pretty good. He said, and Mickey, he's talking about the two New York Times published studies that just came out. One was from the University of Oxford, right, the Computational Propaganda Research Project, and the other by an organization called New Knowledge. Which is essentially staffed by individuals from the national security state.
Kevin Roos wrote about this at the New York Times. That was one of the stories that I was referring to, that they claimed they had these two smoking gun stories. Again, kind of like reliance on prop or not. Now they're relying on new knowledge, right? It gets a little Orwellian. But go ahead, continue for us.
You're right. It's a really Orwellianly named outfit for sure. So Mate says this. He says, based on all of this data, and he's referring to these two new studies alleging Russiagate interference. Based on all of this data, we can draw this picture of Russian social media activity. It was mostly unrelated to the 2016 election, microscopic in reach, engagement, and spending, and juvenile or absurd in its content. And Jameson, interestingly, in Cyber War, does a whole chapter on just sort of how juvenile the content was from these Russian troll farms, which is sort of counter the insert argument. But in any case, he goes on. This leads to the inescapable conclusion, as the New Knowledge study itself acknowledges, that, quote, the operation's focus on elections was merely a small subset of its activity. They qualify that accurate narrative by saying it misses nuance and deserves more contextualization. Alternatively, perhaps it deserves some minimal reflection that a juvenile social media operation with such a small focus on elections is being widely portrayed, and here's the kicker, being widely portrayed, a la Rachel Maddow, right, being widely portrayed as a seismic threat that may well have decided the 2016 contest. So Mate really sort of says, look, there's much ado about nothing. And yet, as Chase and Mickey, you both point out, it seems that we're still continually flogging it on MSNBC and CNN and Washington Post and New York Times and on and on. And that leads to sort of maybe the last thing we should consider, which is who wins, who benefits from right. this obsessive focus on Russiagate.
Before we get into that, Rob Williams, and take another break, Roos in the New York Times, right, in this reporting, this allegedly blockbuster story of these two reports, again, Nolan Higdon and I just wrote about this and for the United States of Distraction book, those same reports concluded, the ones that you just mentioned, that are highlighted in the New York Times, that it was irresponsible to claim that Russia, quote, definitively swung the election because the explicitly political content was a small percentage of the overall content shared on social media. In fact, political content comprised just, quote, 11% of the total content, and only one-third of user engagement with that content was related to the election. And as I said prior, there is no definitive metric to prove whether or not that specifically Russian messaging or massaging actually influenced people's voting, even if they tried. Again, also noteworthy, let's not forget that a few years ago, the CIA was denying that election hacking was even a thing, only to come out once WikiLeaks released Vault 7, which showed the CIA not only admitted that they could hack and meddle in other countries' elections, but they could make it look like it came from anywhere else.
That's right.
So the last point I wanted to make before we go to break is the new book by Yochai Benkler et al. Over at Harvard. In that book, they look at the American media ecosystem from 2015 through 17, and they found that although, quote, the clickbait factories, the Russians, and Cambridge Analytica all took advantage of the intentional design of Facebook's system, the authors did not find significant evidence to confirm that these efforts swayed the outcome of the 2016 election.
That book called Network Propaganda. I just found it.
It's a brand new book that actually continues the refutation of this. And I think, again, this is why when I say we're trying to sort of say, okay, well, there's some information here that's not garbage, but how we perceive it and how it might be spun, that is based on our assumptions and our confirmation bias, which you so aptly point out in the work by Jameson. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're talking with the communications scholar Rob Williams. He's a longtime contributor to Project Censored, author of numerous books, articles, and so forth. He will join us for the remainder of the program after this brief musical break to continue our conversation about cyber war. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're joined by communications scholar Rob Williams, no stranger to the Project Censored world and audience, longtime contributor to the Project's books, websites. Rob Williams has worked with us off and on for a number of years, has been affiliated with the Action Coalition for Media Education, also the Vermont Independent. Rob teaches a wide range of communications classes at University of Vermont, Champlain College, Sacred Heart University in New England. And Rob and I often are crossing paths across the U.S. at conferences, summits, and so forth, talking about issues like we are today. Today's program has been focusing on cyber war. Russiagate is us, looking at the ongoing state of affairs with U.S. and Russia and the claims that Russia tipped the 2016 election. So, Rob Williams, before the break, we just went through a number of reasons and a number of scholarly studies that are really putting question marks after these claims, including folks like Masha Gessen at the New York Review of Books nearly 2 years ago. In an essay called Russia, the Conspiracy Trap, leftist writer at Counterpunch, Paul Street, recently noted about this Russian obsession. And Paul Street wrote, it was a deadly diversion from issues that ought to matter more to those claiming to oppose Trump in the name of democracy and the common good, namely racism, voter suppression, which may well have elected Trump, by the way. This is what Paul Street argues in a Counterpunch piece. He then goes on to say, what about healthcare, plutocracy, police and prison, statism, immigrant rights, economic exploitation and inequality, sexism, environmental ruination, you know, stuff like that. Wow. We add to the list Clinton's weak campaigning in hotly contested states, GOP gerrymandering. There's a lot of other things here that went on, not to mention that especially in Rust Belt states, Clinton was not popular because of her husband's positions on NAFTA welfare reform and the eventual consequences of the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I just talked forever and didn't say anything about Russia. So maybe I'm channeling some Nate Silver here, which I don't normally do.
I think, you know, to kind of put a bow on it, Mickey, and I think what you just laid out there is really important. I think the Russiagate meme, such as it is, has really become kind of this rationale for demonizing or marginalizing or censoring anyone in the United States, any organization, any individual who doesn't toe the Russiagate party line is somehow suspect. And beyond the name calling, which is troublesome enough, is actual policies that are being put in place to censor or marginalize or algorithmically censor, as you and I have talked about before, with the propaganda model of news, legitimate news organizations and outlets that don't kowtow to the U.S. imperial perspective. And I mentioned this at the end of the review that you were kind enough to publish at projectcensor.org on the cyber war book, but we've seen this with the Atlantic Council purging more than 800 suspect Facebook organizational accounts. We've seen this with Google's algorithmic censorship, in which they've gamed the algorithm to marginalize U.S. news outlets like Truthdig or Alternet or Truthout, to name three, which are all critical of the U.S. imperial status quo. We've seen this Russiagate meme used as a club with which to beat any organization or any individual in the United States who is raising questions about the direction of U.S. imperial policy. And I think that's really troublesome. And I think that's really, at the end of the day, the usefulness of the Russiagate meme to the powers that be. And it's really too bad that Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who I think is a good scholar, has fallen into this particular well, this bottomless pit that it seems to be the Russiagate story.
One of the more recent of the efforts to censor is coming from an organization called NewsGuard. And Manar Mahawish over at Mint Press News has been writing about this quite a bit, NewsGuard Technologies. And we're going to have Manar on the program next week, and she's going to be talking about exactly that issue. And that's, of course, going to be a continuation of a show that Chase and I did not long ago about this kind of meddling in social media censorship. Chase.
Rob, you're absolutely right that independent news outlets have been the first victims of this Russiagate hysteria. And it's worth pointing out who the winners of this are, who might benefit. The obvious first party would be Hillary Clinton and their campaign as a way of kind of sweeping under the rug why they lost and perhaps setting her up for another bid for the presidency in 2020. But I would actually argue that Trump, even though he's at the center of these attacks, has a lot to gain from these attacks because it's become so much the leading arrow that everybody in the mainstream media attacks him with that they actually don't focus on the real policies and arguments to attack Trump with. And therefore, Trump wins support from viewers because they see that he's just being attacked on these non-issues. So I think Trump actually has a lot to gain from this Russia hysteria.
That's really insightful, Chase. And it's this strange kind of weird Mobius strip, right, where it just kind of keeps coming back around in these really strange ways. Mickey, I was just looking at the NewsGuard site that you mentioned, and Manar, of course, is fantastic, and it was great to have her involved in the conference in Marin last October. She's doing really good work at Mint Press. But, you know, I was struck by this one line at the NewsGuard tech site. A SWAT team of NewsGuard analysts operates 24/7 to identify suddenly trending purveyors of unreliable news among sites that NewsGuard has not yet rated and warn internet users about them in real time. That's like what happened to critical media literacy, Meg?
Yeah, what happened to having people think critically and independently among themselves?
Yeah.
And of course, Chase could be chiming in here about his own work with Tribeworthy and the crowd-contested media. This is, again, now that we've had the meme of fake news drifting around and has been weaponized, now we're seeing the calls that it's off leash. Now the same kind of groups that not only helped create it and got off leash with it, they're now trying to benefit by appearing to come up with solutions for it.
What's especially creepy about this NewsGuard solution is that it's actually not a consumer-focused solution. They're actually trying to integrate their green, yellow, and red list, essentially. They're trying to integrate that with the devices themselves so that users don't even have the option of opting in or out of these ratings.
That's really strange. Chase, what you're doing with crowd-contested media seems to me to make a lot more sense. Let's actually have it out in the public square rather than turning over judgments about what is true and what is not, what is fake and what is real to some SWAT team of paid corporate assassins. That's really strange. So thank you for calling that to my attention. But, you know, back to cyber war, we can't even rely on some of our most gifted critical media literacy scholars to get it right in books published by Oxford University Press, then we really got to sort of pay attention. And I guess that's why I waded into the Russiagate conversation when this book came out. And I really, as I said in my review, I really tried to approach it with an open mind because I was curious as to what Ms. Jameson would say. And as we've talked about, I was really baffled, flummoxed, bamboozled by where she ended up in the book. So I hope people will read the review closely and read the book closely and draw their own conclusions. But it's a fascinating reflection of where we are right now politically.
And Rob Williams, you know, after the midterm elections, now is the incessant and never-ending 2020 campaign. It's already happening, and of course, we're already seeing plenty of bias and things going on in coverage of this and so forth, but not to put you on the prognosticator platform too much here. That's never a fun place to be because we never know what will happen in the future. But I can't at least help but think that Russia and where people fall on it is somehow going to fall in to some kind of litmus testing of Democratic candidates. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the U.S. empire always needs an enemy to demonize. We've seen with the collapse of communism, the replacement of communism with terrorism. We've seen Al-Qaeda sort of disappear and then morph into ISIS, which, as your listeners probably know, was, you know, in some ways a creation of the West. And now Russia, which has its own regional interests in mind in Eurasia. Russia is emerging strangely after 30 years of, the Cold War ending. Russia is emerging as kind of the demon du jour, along with Iran. So I think you're right. I think we're going to hear a lot more about Russia and Russia hacking in the next almost 2 years running up to 2020, alas. But I think you're right.
So, Rob, one of the scariest things that I find about this Russiagate narrative, as well as the FBI investigations into Donald Trump's dealings with Russia, is that we are taking a other superpower with nuclear weapons that we have a history of going and having Cold War with, and now we're putting Trump in a position where we almost back him into a corner where if he doesn't do something aggressive towards Russia, then we believe that he's Russia's puppet. So it almost incentivizes Trump to start some drama with Russia to try to prove to the American people and the American media that he is not a stooge of Putin. So I think that that's actually the scariest potential route that we might go down. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, Chase, I think you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, we need to be in dialogue, we being the United States. The United States needs to be in dialogue with Russia because these are two countries that possess lots of nuclear weapons and have regional and global interests in mind. And I'm with Stephen Cohen, the great Russian expert out of New York City, who says anybody who is pro-U.S. national security ought to be about dialogue with Russia, not demonization of Russia, but dialogue with Russia, because Russia and the United States and China, and there are other countries in the mix, but these are the countries that are the most powerful players in the world right now. And to not dialogue with each other leads to a much more ominous situation, which you just described, Jay. So absolutely, I think that's the biggest danger with this Russiagate hysteria, is that we will end up with a president or a government in Washington that is much more aggressive towards Russia than need be, especially given all of the geopolitics on the table. So I think you're absolutely right.
Also, Rob Williams, you know, two things to say. One, this is in no way an endorsement of Putin or the Kremlin. There's plenty of authoritarian tendencies and support of right-wing movements coming out of Russia. I mean, this isn't a show about Russian politics, but I want to make sure that listeners are aware that this isn't an example of, you know, have some kind of like fawning praise here about it. We're trying to unpack a complicated issue, and we outlined it very clearly from the outset of the show. And of course, your review does same. People can read your review online. Cyber War, hashtag Russiagate is us, capital U-S. That's at projectcensored.org. So one thing to remember. The other thing is the major media outlets, certainly whether it's CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, we can't forget that these are the major news media that led us into the Iraq War in 2003 with completely bogus claims of weapons of mass destruction, turned out to be weapons of mass deception. And again, as Gore Vidal would quip, right, we live in the United States of amnesia. So I think having a healthy sense of skepticism is important toward these stories. And I feel, speaking personally, I feel like I'm ever steamrolled by the next New York Times blockbuster breaking news story about how Russia did it this week. And I think that that's also the pressure that scoops up more and more people that are on the sidelines and they have questions. They kind of get pushed and pushed further and further until it becomes absurd to not agree. And I think it's a propaganda tactic that usually works over a period of 6 months to 2 years. And I think that we need to see the long view historically that way. And I do think that this story is kind of shaping up to be one that might be like that. What are your thoughts on that?
You're absolutely right, Mickey, and maybe this is a good place to end. I'm looking at a Salon.com article from just a couple of weeks ago, which is an interview with Kathleen Hall Jamison, who wrote the book Cyber War. It's written by a guy named Chauncey DeVega. It's got almost 2 million views on Facebook, according to the icon here, but the very first sentence captures it. Chauncey writes in Salon.com about the book Cyber War. The Russian government's campaign to interfere in the 2016 American presidential election in order to install Donald Trump in the White House may be one of the greatest intelligence operations in modern history. And right there, the scholarly work is being leveraged in the U.S. popular news media as a done deal. And I've seen this dozens of times since I read the book 3 or 4 weeks ago, how the conclusions of the book are conflated into this anti-Russia hysteria. And it's really troubling.
I've seen two interviews, and she has been a bit combative when pushed to the wall for specifics. That's not usually a great sign in terms of confidence in argument. Rob Williams, last thing here. And this is a conversation that Nolan Higdon and I were having with Greg Ruggiero over at City Lights about this United States of Distraction book, because this topic kept coming up, and certainly this Senate report, new knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. But one person that emerged out of there that's working with them is Renee DiResta, one of the researchers, and she made a couple of interesting points. So I wanted to put this out there and then end on this point with you, hear your thoughts. She was one of the researchers involved in analyzing social media data for the Senate Intelligence Committee, and she wrote an overview of the implications. Quote, "There is a war happening," wrote DiResta. "We are immersed in an evolving, ongoing conflict, an information world war in which state actors, terrorists, and ideological extremists leverage the social infrastructure underpinning everyday life to sow discord and erode shared reality. The conflict is still being processed as a series of individual skirmishes, a collection of disparate, localized truth in narrative problems, but these battles are all connected." Now, taking away from that, let's take Russia out of that. Does this, in your mind, apply to almost anything or any side? Or, I mean, again, I think she's hitting on a really serious problem, that the epistemological crisis that we face is exacerbating extraordinarily. But I don't think that this means they get a Trojan horse to ride Russia in.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I'm sure you know that Renee DiResta is the director of research at New Knowledge.
Yes,
the organization
that's right.
Earlier.
She says the human mind is the territory. If you aren't a combatant, you are the territory. And once a combatant wins over a sufficient number of minds, they have the power to influence culture and society, policy and politics. Right. Like, you mean the New York Times? You mean Fox News? You mean Roger Stone?
That's right.
Fill in the blanks, Rob Williams.
I think Ms. DiResta has skin in the game. I'd love to sit down with her and talk about critical media literacy education and crowd-contested news as two solutions to the problem, rather than couching everything in this sort of good versus evil Manichaean dualistic framework, which I find really troubling, actually.
So, Rob Williams, we live in interesting times, you know.
Yes, we do.
Blessed and cursed, I'm sure. You know, again, so there is a battle for the integrity of our information infrastructure. It's not just something that's happening from Russia. This is an ongoing topic, certainly, that I know interests you and that we've covered at Project Censored. To end the program with the great Henry Giroux, in the end, there is no democracy without informed citizens. And what we're seeing is really a battle to see who gets to do the informing. And that's, again, why I think we'll all agree that critical media literacy education is the way to go to create the informed citizens, the critical thinking citizens that we need in this 21st century digital media battlefield.
That's right. And Mickey, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you, because I haven't said it yet on the show, how much I really value Project Censored as an institution, but also the new book, the 2019 book, which I'm about to teach with my students here at the University of Vermont, is the best yet. And I'm really pleased that you all continue to do the work that you do on the West Coast and that we are all able to participate in that. So I hope anyone listening will pick up a copy of Censored 2019, check out projectcensored.org online, and really get involved, support the organization, contribute to it, share it with teachers and students who can do the research and make a difference in that way. And it's never before more vital than it is now. So thanks for all you're doing.
Rob Williams, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to have you on the Project Censored show. We're going to be sending out a mailer on the projectcensored.org list about the review that we discussed today, the review Cyberwar, hashtag Russiagate is us. Rob Williams, you can be reached at rob.williams@madriver.com. I know you like to hear from people. Thanks from Chase and I and our associate producer, Dennis. Thanks so much for joining the show with us today, Rob. Really appreciate your time and appreciate your work.
Dennis, Chase, Mickey, thanks so much, and keep it rolling, and we'll see you guys soon.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer of the program, and I am co-host with Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored show airs on over 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work and find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on social media, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, confine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.